on the Phillies, who wound up losing 8-5. That series now tied at one game apiece. Our weather forecast calls for skies to become mostly sunny today with a high of 57 degrees. Tonight's low 37 degrees. Sunny, breezy, and warmer tomorrow with a high of 71. 10 minutes after 8 o'clock, for WGTD News, I'm Gregory Berg. The morning show is next. We welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I could not be more excited to be sitting across today from John Hembrock and Ann Morse Hembrock, who've both been on the morning show any number of times, and particularly in recent years talking about the wonderful comic strip The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee, which appears in the Kenosha News and in newspapers all across the country. And this is a comic strip that was created by John Hembrock. It made its debut way back in 2006, I think, which seems incredible that that much time has gone on. And the reason we want to talk about The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee once again today, which is written and drawn by John Hembrock and colored by Ann Morse Hembrock, is because the comic strip won the highest award that can be given to a newspaper comic strip, short of a Pulitzer Prize. And we're talking about the Silver Reuben for newspaper comic strips bestowed by the National Cartoonist Society Award. And how long ago was that you were given this award?
September 15th.
Okay.
Yeah, so just recently.
Yeah, no kidding. So anyway, we obviously wanted to have the Hembrocks back on the morning show to talk about this momentous occasion and this award that was given to The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee, which I'm sure many of you enjoy as I do. So, John Hembrock, Ann Morse Hembrock, we welcome both of you back to the morning show.
Greg, I'm really glad to be here. This is great. Thank
good.
You.
Good. Ann, are you?
Am I in?
Yeah, good, good, good. Just making sure you're up and loud. Good, great. Good to have both of you here. Absolutely wonderful. So we'll get to the award and all of that and the big night when this was announced and so on. But for the sake of any listeners who maybe don't remember kind of the backstory of all of this, I think it would be good to at least briefly retrace some of that. And maybe we should begin with the fact, John, that long before the debut of The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee, you had long pondered and even attempted a couple of launches of comic strips before this comic strip that finally took flight. Just sketch that for our listeners.
Yeah, well, I want to say it goes back, and Ann and I disagree on this, but I want to say 30 years. Our oldest son was, I think, a year old. And literally, I came home one night from work. I worked in Chicago, and I came home and I said to Ann, just out of the blue, you know, I'd like to do a comic strip. And Greg, I have no idea where that came from. I think she had been influencing me when I was sleeping at night, giving me little little talks about what I wanted to do. Because she was always in the comics.
Comics fan.
and decided to give it a try. And I had no idea where to begin. I mean, really had no idea. I went to the library, asked the librarian, you know, who do I talk to about doing a comic? And you get these stares and, oh, well, you know, maybe try this or this or this. And so they put me in touch with information that would get me in the door, you know, which I didn't have any idea at the time that this door was heavily guarded and that it took a lot to get in, even to get that door to open. So I tried for years to get various comic creations through that door and into the hands of these syndicates. And one of the first comics I worked on actually was one that we had created together. It was called Second Nature. We did it for a couple years and sent it off to the major syndicates. There were quite a few at the time. And got some positive feedback, which was great. And when you get that feedback, it's like when you buy a lottery ticket for the first time and you win, you think, oh, this is easy. I can do this. Well, it wasn't that easy, but they offered encouragement and said, try this or come back to us in 6 months or no, this is not what we're looking for.
Do I remember correctly that when you created that and you felt really good about it, a problem was that maybe some other comic strip had been launched right around the same time that was a little too similar, which points to the fact that even if you come up with something wonderful, if there's already something in the pipeline that resembles it, that the timing just might not be right. Am I remembering that correctly?
You are correct. The timing on Second Nature was they had just launched the comic Over the Hedge. So, yes.
And I'd like to pull something in here. He recently dug out all his rejection letters from those years before we went to the award ceremony. I think we just wanted to remind ourselves. And for anybody listening out there that's trying to, I don't know how many people still try to pursue syndication because there are so many more avenues now, but there was something that we could see in those letters now, having been in the business for so long, that we kind of missed at the time. And it was that despite all the encouragement, all the kind words about, yes, you have talent, we love the art, we love the writing, what they were subtly saying in each of these letters was, but not this concept. We can't sell this concept. Come back to us with a new concept. And we must have spent 4 more years sending them more of the same with the mistaken idea, oh, they just haven't seen enough of this concept yet. No, they had seen enough of the concept. They were telling us to switch gears, and we were not getting that memo.
You just didn't see that in their words.
Yeah, somehow. I can see that now. But at the time, that was really going over our heads.
Fascinating. By the way, Anne, before we resume the storyline for the creation of Edison Lee, tell us about this long-held love that you've had for newspaper comic strips. When did that begin, and for any particular reason?
I think I was like a lot of kids whose first reading wasn't books. My first reading was my parents' Peanuts comic book collections. And when I say the first Peanuts, I mean the really old books from the 50s when Charlie Brown, when they all looked like really little kids and Snoopy's kind of a puppy. Between that and my dad was a big fan of New Yorker cartoons, so there were always like Charles Adams books around the house and things like that, that I think children understand. They learn to read better when there's a picture that goes with what they're reading, and they're drawn to that. So I was reading comics really early. And to be fair, too, ours was a newspaper house. When we talk about the generation that doesn't read newspapers anymore, it goes way back further than just our current batch of kids. It goes to John's and my, to our generation. Already there were many people when we were growing up who didn't even get a newspaper, who got all their news from the TV or from the radio. So I grew up in a newspaper house. My parents were avid readers. That kind of pushed me into reading. And so I had definite pet comics that I followed. I was a big fan of Bloom County, so much so that before we were married, I had started like cutting them out and putting them in a scrapbook for posterity because there weren't any book collections at that time. Wow. So when he says I was like infecting him in his sleep, well, maybe I was.
Fair enough, and a good thing you did. And John, we probably haven't even said this yet, but your professional life includes drawing, so it's not that you came to this with a complete lack of expertise, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I was actually, and this story, Anne gets tired of hearing it, but one of my accounts in Chicago at the agency was Keebler. So I was drawing Keebler elves for about 3 or 4 years. And it was while working on that account that I realized that I could do cartooning. You know, because prior to that, Greg, I wasn't into comics. I wasn't into superheroes as a kid, you know, any of that. So this just came out of nowhere and just smacked me in the head and said, this is what you're going to do. And I'm glad I did because I enjoy doing it. But boy, it sure took a long time to get to that point.
Right. So as you were spinning the tale earlier, you made some of your first attempts, but with rejections. And although I'm sure those rejections stung, something about them, I guess there was enough encouragement in the content of those rejection letters that you did not lose hope.
No. In fact, I just kept my head down and kept pushing ahead because it's interesting. I got to the point where I knew that this is what I was going to do. I just knew that. And you're very lucky in life if you get to that point where you see something that you want your life to be all about and you pursue it and you know with a passion. There are so many people wandering around looking for what they want to do in life, and this was what I wanted to do, and it hit me, and I was going to make it happen no matter what. And I had no idea at the time the odds that this was going to be, you know, and I'm glad I didn't because it may have discouraged me. But it's interesting. One of those letters that I found was from an editor, and I'm good friends with this editor now, and the letter, he or she, I won't even tell you if it was gender, because the editor commented about how the writing fell flat. And it just didn't have what it would take to be syndicated. And I sent this editor that letter just right before the awards. This editor knew that I was nominated for this big award. Mm. And I sent it to, and I'll say it. She got back to me and said, it was just appalled. She says, oh, my God, did I say that? Oh, my goodness. You know, she felt so horrible about saying something. And I looked at Ann. I said, this isn't really a bad thing. It's constructive criticism like that that helps you move on and get better about what you're working on.
I do think it was jarring at the time, though, because it was coming at the same time that other editors were saying the humor was good. So this is another difficult thing to navigate, is you hear one thing from one editor and you hear another thing from another editor, and it reminds you how subjective all of this is.
Sure, absolutely. What I'm also thinking about as you're describing this is the fact that obviously, we're talking about two aspects of a comic strip, the visual and the writing. I mean, the words that are in the comic strip. I mean, unless it's one of those rare instances of a comic strip that has few, if any, words. But yours had words and it had drawings. And I suspect that, you know, in a sense, you're kind of juggling two balls. And was there one that felt more comfortable than the other? Or did it always feel like a single piece and you felt like it was just kind of one artistic expression?
You know, no one's ever asked me that question in that way before. And that's interesting, Greg, you bring that up, because yes, the two do go hand in hand. When I'm writing, it's funny, I'll write a gag, I do my writing on my laptop or my desktop, and I come up with ideas. But then when I draw them up, and Anne will often hear me laughing, because once I draw them up and I see them on the paper, they're really funny. It takes sometimes that moment when you see the physical drawings of these characters that adds that little final touch of humor that makes it work.
Interesting.
When Hillary Price was here, part of her talk was she said that there's kind of a famous idea that there are writers who draw and artists who write. You know, that each comic comes, that you have a strength in one direction or another. And this is going to sound a little arrogant, but I think John's one of those that it's equally weighted.
Mm.
And I do think that's a little unusual.
Right. And I should think most people at least probably regard one as a more natural gift than the other, and the other kind of hauls the other one along. But yeah, that's cool that you felt comfortable with both talents. So at some point, does the message start to sink in that we need to create a new concept, and ultimately The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee is that concept?
Absolutely. You know, I had done a comic with a little boy in it, and he was a minor character, but as I developed this comic, this little boy just kept screaming out to me, demanding more and more attention. And so I finally gave in and said, okay, let's see what you can do, kid. And I started writing some comics for this little boy. He was a smart little genius kid. And, you know, it got mediocre response because it was just a typical kid doing typical things, which you see. And there was nothing really extraordinary about him. And then we had the 2000 presidential election and the whole thing with George Bush and the hanging chads and the delay and all that in the Supreme Court. And that got me riled up, Greg, and I started just out of the blue, I just started throwing in these adult situations, this political humor, some of it, a lot of it, into this world with this little kid. It's like putting everything in a blender and turning it on, just seeing what comes out. And it's just the science angle of it and the politics and this little boy and the coming out of his mouth and all that. And I said, that resonated with me. I thought, this is really fun. Let's see where this goes. And I did some of those and I sent them off. And that's finally what got the attention of one of the editors at King Features, who said, I like this. Let's develop this into something more. So that's what it took. I give the election credit for a lot.
Wow.
And I think a really important part of that story is that it was missing passion up until that point. If you don't have anything particular to say, if you just see a job you'd like to do, oh, I'd like to do a comic strip, that's one thing. His work really came to life when he now felt he had something to say. And I think the syndicates, they're looking for a point of view to a limit. They're not necessarily looking for a soapbox because then they can't sell that across broad audiences, but they are looking for heart. They're looking for something that's coming from a place deeper inside you that's not just on the surface. And I do think that's part of what made them suddenly take notice.
Interesting. So that process of developing it, that was the term I think you used. Mm-hmm. I mean, when this King Features person said, I like this. So what did that development process look like between that moment he said, I like this, to the moment it launched? What needed to happen?
Well, I tell people it's a lot like when you're merging onto the highway on it. On ramp, it's sort of, you have to get up to speed before you can jump into traffic because it's a brutal business. I mean, it's a lot of work. They have to first of all make sure that you can deliver. Because I had someone just recently look at me and say, "Oh my gosh, you have to make 365 comics a year?" And I said, "Yes," and they couldn't believe it. It had never dawned on them. Yes, one a day, you know. But it's interesting. The development was painful in a lot of ways because they not only need to get it, make sure you can do the job, but they have to make sure that their sales team can sell it. And so it's a whole committee that's making decisions about it. And at one point they wanted me to ditch his glasses, you know. They wanted me to get rid of the grandfather, which the grandfather in the comic, he's my voice. People ask me, but he's my voice. A lot of things. And we pushed back on a lot of stuff. And some of the stuff we let slide by. Like he had a little brother at one time originally, and we let that go.
But we snuck him back in as a cousin.
Yeah. The drawing changed a little bit. And I don't have any issues with that because I wasn't happy how he was drawn before the development. But it was about a year-long process where they needed to make sure that they could sell this to newspapers because it's a hard sell. Mm-hmm. It really is. And if the sales guys aren't on board, you don't have anything. They're not going to – it's going nowhere.
It's not only that it's hard to sell. You have to think about the fact that something's going to have to leave to get – it's not as though when they buy a new comic, they make more space on the page.
Right.
They're going to kick somebody else out, somebody who already has a lot of readers, who's not going to be happy about that choice. So the editor has to be able to defend the new choice.
Right. If we're dumping Hagar the Horrible, it's for this great reason. We have this new comic strip we think you're going to like or whatever.
We were very lucky in that Foxtrot had stopped doing daily comics. I don't know if you remember that comic.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Don Amon or something?
Bill Amon,
yeah.
And they pushed up my launch because he had retired his dailies in the late summer of 2006. And so they pushed up my launch because all of a sudden you have 1,000 holes opening up for newspapers and everyone's scrambling
which
to fill those holes.
Which almost never happens.
Yeah. Right, right.
So they knew they had to get this in right away. So, and I never did know, and I never talked to my editor about that, if they knew this was coming way before they launched me. I doubt it. I doubt that that had anything to do with them launching my feature, but... So it's luck. A lot of it's luck. Things like that where these holes open up and they just scramble to fill them.
Right. Well, and of course, as we said, your comic strip ultimately debuted in November of 2006. And that's at a point in time when newspapers are already, in a sense, in retreat, in decline. So in a sense, although the Foxtrot thing, that was great timing. But in another way, you're trying to break into what is a retreating market. And so... The fact that you ended up being successful at this point in time, that's even more notable, it seems to me.
To your point, when he just said 1,000 holes opened up, if Foxtrot was still in papers today and it quit, it would probably be more like 500 holes because that's how many papers have shut down.
Wow.
It isn't that Bill's strip wouldn't be popular. It's that there wouldn't be as many markets for it to be in.
Right.
Well, they used to launch 2 or 3 features a year. Of which one maybe would make it past the first year. I mean, it's difficult to. It's always that first year mark. If you can make it past a year or two, then you're okay. And I don't know that we would have made it had not those papers opened up. It's hard to say.
Yeah.
You know, but we did. So
another, just to stay with your point of how things have changed. When he says they used to launch, you know, 2 or 3 a year, that's every syndicate used to launch 2 or 3 strips a year. There would be the fall launches, there would be the spring launches. And for context, by 2008, the door had slammed. There were a couple of years where no one launched anything.
Wow.
And now they maybe launch 1 or 2 a year, sometimes only 1, sometimes nothing. Mm. He actually was, like, if you were looking at graduating classes, his was one of the last launches in that environment where there were multiple launches.
Wow.
And of the strips that launched the same year that he launched, some of them stuck around, but very few of the strips that launched after that gained traction. And that isn't because of the quality of the strips. It's how much tighter the market got.
Right. The marketplace is a very, very different place now. It's so interesting, too, to think about. I mean, we think of comic strips. I mean, I think sometimes we very much take them for granted in terms of the work that is involved in putting them together and so on. And also something that's just supposed to be fun and entertaining. It's really hard to kind of reconcile that in our minds with it also being brutal. That is, it is a brutal business. And there is a lot that goes on behind the scenes that must feel really, really harsh. And it's just sort of interesting to think about that in this particular arena.
I had to watch him continue to meet that daily deadline while dealing with the deaths of 3 family members in less than 18 months.
Wow.
And you still have to do the job.
Yeah.
There is a relentlessness to the responsibility. Well, nevertheless, despite all that, The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee launches on November 12th. 2006, and it's still very much with us. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with John Hambrock and Ann Morse Hambrock, talking today about their comic strip, The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee. It does say John Hambrock at the top. He draws it, he writes it, but Ann colors it. So this is and I can tell already from these conversations, and John, I'm sure you'd be the first to agree, Ann plays a very significant role. Even if she wasn't coloring the strip, just as an advisor and sounding board and so on.
Oh, absolutely. There's something I'm not sure about, I throw it at her. And if I get a laugh, it's a go. If I get a stare or a, what were you thinking? Or, oh, my God. Or better yet, if she faints, then I know it's a dud. So,
well, and I've also written some of the gags every once in a while. Less in the last few years.
John, one of the things about The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee that makes it distinct from other comic strips that come to mind, like Doonesbury or Sherman's Lagoon, is that there is almost nothing in the way of serialization. I mean, once in a while, but by and large, this is a comic strip where On Monday, it's something, and on Tuesday, it's something completely different. The same characters, of course, but you are not tying stories together in arcs over the course of multiple days, on a regular basis, at least. Is that always the way it's been, and is it that way for any particular reason? I mean, is that just the way your brain works, or for any other reason? Is that something you consciously decided that you did not want to write this strip in that format of ongoing stories over the course of successive days?
Planning is what I narrow it down to. I do one big series a year, and I just finished one up this summer. I did one last summer where they were at the beach and they get swept out, Edison and his grandfather, and they wind up on a Russian sub and then on a deserted island.
Oh, yeah, just, yeah, yeah.
It just sort of wandered. And that's how they work. And sometimes they go on for 6, 8, 9, 10 weeks. And I try to do one of those. But my problem, Greg, is when I dive into an idea for a series like that, I have no idea going in where it's going to wind up. Mm. I really have no idea. So sometimes I did one years ago where I backed myself into a corner and I went to Anne and I said, how am I going to get out of this? And if you remember Monty Python, when they do a sketch and then they'd go, and now for something completely different.
Right.
And I thought I could just do that. I could just say, okay, we're at the end of this series. We have nowhere we're going with it. So let's just move on to something else. And I think that would be my way to get out of a series that I don't have any idea where it's headed. I like series because it's a different muscle completely. Mm. You really have to think about redundancies. Like when I first did my first long series, I would begin each week or even every couple days with, and now here they are on a deserted island, you know, and Anne was like, you don't need to tell them where they are every day because people are following you. So they're difficult. I find the joke a day comics easier to do. Huh. You know, but sometimes they're not as funny, I think, as some of the longer series. And it's interesting, the feedback I get from readers on the longer series are, the feedback I get is I get a lot more of it. People love those long series.
So. Interesting.
Yeah.
Of course, even if you don't serialize the way some comic strips do, you do have themes that come through again and again and certain motifs and so on. One of them that has leapt out at me recently is all the times that Grandpa and Edison end up at Jolly Burgers, which is obviously a fast food franchise of your own creation. And they show up there. And recently, when you look on the website for Arcamax, I think, which is one of the places you can see your strip online, and just by coincidence, off to the side is a little banner ad for McDonald's bringing adult Happy Meals. And so I wonder what McDonald's thinks of Jolly Burger, because obviously it's not a place that serves very good food.
That is an endless well of ideas. I love Jolly Burger. I could do a Jolly Burger a week. You know, it just never stops because, just because of what it is. It's so fun.
There's so much to work with there between the employment conditions and the toys they give out and the food that they serve and Orville's just the way he is in the world and the way customers are in the world. It scratches a lot of itches.
Well, and food plays a very prominent role. I loved a recent strip where Grandpa is apparently sticking two full sticks of butter onto his English muffins. When Edison, I think, asks him, what, two sticks? Well, yeah, one for the nooks and the other for the crannies.
I got to tell you, so when he hands them off to me to color, you know, I often don't even read them until I'm halfway through the coloring process because I'm so focused on getting them done. Once I read that one, I laughed out loud, and it was one of those that every time I see it, I laugh out loud again. I just thought that was so brilliant, ones for the nooks and ones for the crannies.
I think it especially leapt out at me because my best friend, who's watching his weight very, very carefully, he mentioned right around the time that strip appeared that his breakfast English muffin, wherever he has breakfast, they buttered it by accident because he usually eats a dry English muffin with nothing on it.
That defeats the purpose of an English muffin.
I can't even imagine what that would taste like. So then to see Grandpa with two full sticks of butter, that just that was funny to me. I wanted to mention another strip from fairly recently that I absolutely loved. And this was one of your rare single panel strips. Those don't happen too often. And Edison and his dad are playing catch, of all things. And, of course, one can hardly imagine that bespeckled little nerd playing catch, but his dad's insisting on it. So, see, how did that go? So, the dad says to Edison, you're supposed to catch the ball. And Edison fires right back and says, you're supposed to hit the glove.
Yeah. It's,
that just seems like some kind of metaphor for a lot of the things that we don't understand.
That sums up their relationship and who he is probably better than most. So that's exactly. It's so funny when I throw sports at him because he just turns it on his head. He has no interest in sports whatsoever. And to have his dad continually try to drag him into football or whatever it is, there's always a funny ending with those. I like doing those.
Right. And talk for a moment about Edison's brilliance. I mean, he is especially, although he's really interested in politics and current events, I mean, much more so than the typical 10-year-old. I mean, probably his most ferocious passion and what we see the most from him is his incredible love of science and the crazy inventions and so on that he creates. Does that spring out of your own interest in science? And to what extent do you have to be careful about the way in which you write about some of that stuff to be scientifically correct?
Well, first of all, I put brilliance in quotations because he's and that's always been the point. He thinks he's smarter than he is.
Ah, right. Good point.
I've always loved science. When I was in school, I was huge in biology, and I wanted to be a marine biologist, actually, is what I wanted to do. But, you know, of course, I chose cartooning instead, or graphics for that. I love science. I love physics. I love putting it into the comic. And I do it with a fair degree of accuracy. I mean, I don't just throw stuff out there because readers will nail you.
Right. In the same way that the writers of the Big Bang Theory,
absolutely,
the sitcom that went off the air not too long ago, but that, I mean, they also, I think, write what they write with a very careful eye towards being as correct as they can be.
Because somebody will point out your error. And I have an example. Years ago, I did a comic where reasons for going back to the moon. And it was a one panel. And I had a man on the moon standing on a scale. He had a counterbalance scale on the moon.
The kind you have at the doctor's office.
Ah.
And somebody wrote in and says, well, that kind of a scale wouldn't work on the moon. You know, you can't.
Well, no, it wasn't that the scale wouldn't work. It's that the joke involved gravity being less and that you'd be lighter, that the scale would show you a different number. Scale wouldn't do that on the moon.
Yeah, okay. I forgot to tell you the whole point of the joke was that you'd weigh less on the moon. Hey, look, I lost 50 pounds.
Yeah, okay.
Great. The scale says so. Well, not that scale, because that scale wouldn't work. And I remember when that reader wrote to me and said that,
it was more than one reader.
I had this, it started coming. I thought, oh, I can't wait for this day to be over, please. Just get till tomorrow's comic. Yeah. I mean, big error. And I should have known that, Greg. But you know what? You can't, the scale was too interesting not to draw. It had to be a counterbalance scale. It couldn't be the ones you put on the floor with the
springs. Right,
right. So, but you make mistakes like that. And readers pointed out, but they're very forgiving. They'll move on, and they don't hold grudge too much. But they love pointing out when you make a mistake.
Oh, I am sure they do. In the same way that public radio listeners love to point out when someone has split an infinitive or done something more significant than that. We hear about it, and that's just fine. Well, here you are all these years later. You again, the comic strip has debuted in 2006, and I'm pretty sure you've not gone any kind of hiatus since then. I mean, has it been every single day since November 12th, 2006?
Yes.
Wow. Written in what kind of batches? I mean, do you sit down and just churn, or is that very hard to sort of summarize? I mean,
7 a week.
Okay.
It's really pretty much on deadline. Yeah. No, there's no working ahead. I'm supposed to be, but I don't. I just don't work that way.
There are some artists who do. I think Stephen Pastis is months ahead. Mm. And then they maybe do write in big batches, but...
And then he's off to Tahiti for a little while. But
some of these guys, they work a year. Gals and guys work a year ahead. Mm. Oh, yeah. But I can't imagine that. What does that look like to me? And, you know, to be fair, there are some cartoonists that use gag writers, and that's fine. That happens, and I get it. There are times when I wish I had somebody throwing me stuff that I could just take a week and coast.
Yeah. I should think it's tricky, but not just for that reason, but also the fact that when you write a given strip, it does not appear the next day, not by any means. Mm-hmm. And that makes it tricky for you to be as current as you would probably like to be in terms of commenting on things.
Yeah, I'm supposed to be working 6 weeks. I'm working 3 weeks out. So the stuff I'm writing now will run middle of November.
I think an important point on that is that back when he first launched, that was the news cycle. That was much more in keeping with the news cycle. And there were only a couple people like Gary Trudeau whose syndicates allowed them to be on a shorter leash than that, a shorter deadline than that. Since the internet changed everything, some of the syndicates have changed their deadline schedule and some of them have not. So that there are artists working who are allowed to get like right up to it. But it's a very dangerous thing to do because what if you're dry? Like now you're right up against when it's going to run, and what if you've got nothing?
Right. Yeah. That's an interesting term, dry.
Yeah.
I bet it's a feeling I'm sure you're acquainted with from time to time.
Yes. You get that blank stare, a blank piece of paper, and you don't know what you're going to put on it, and it's frightening sometimes, and then all of a sudden something will just pop up. Think about Grandpa for a minute.
There you go.
An English muffin, and there
right.
you go.
There you go.
Piece of butter. And it's all done.
Or it's time for another trip to Jolly Burger.
It's funny. I always liken it like when someone hits a home run. You know the minute that ball leaves the bat, that's out of the park. And that's how it is with comics. If you write something, you know immediately, oh, this is it. No question.
Right.
I'm going to disagree with that.
What?
In that sometimes, I've heard this from many cartoonists, they just throw that last one in that they thought of to make batch. And they don't even think it's very good, and it's the favorite of the week.
I've had that happen too.
So I don't know that it's always true that you know like which ones are going to hit.
Right. Interesting. Well, it is time for us to talk about this marvelous award given to the brilliant mind of Edison Lee, namely the Silver Ruben for newspaper comic strips. First of all, say a quick word about the organization that bestowed this award, the National Cartoonist Society.
Well, we're a society of about 500 members, cartoonists from all over the world, working in the profession. Most of the newspaper comics you read, most of those are members. It was actually started in 1946 by a small group of about 32, including Rube Goldberg, Milton Kniff, Otto Soglo. A lot of those people were the original members. In fact, Rube Goldberg was the original first president of the NCS, and the Ruben is named after Rube Goldberg, of course.
Okay.
So that's where the big Ruben comes in. It's not a sandwich, you know. It's Rube Goldberg, and the award is actually designed using his characters. It has these, I wish I had a picture of it to show you, Greg, has these figures all around the edge of it. It's this plaque that he designed all those years ago. It's a really wonderful
award.
And
the big award for the Cartoonist of the Year is an actual statue of those figures.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So.
So you were nominated for this award. Had you been, I'm pretty sure you'd been nominated before?
Two other times. I was nominated in 2009 and 2018.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And this was bestowed to you, appears from the photograph I saw, at some kind of big awards banquet?
We have our big Ruben Awards every year. It's where we all get together and say, greet each other. You know, you got to remember, we're all like a big family. So it's like a big family reunion every year. And then we have this big banquet where we hand out the awards for all the different divisions. You know, we have panel cartoons and comic strips and
greeting cards.
And lots of others, yeah. So we had our big convention this year in Kansas City. And I was nominated again. I was up against Mark Tutuli, who does Leo. We had a lot of Leo fans in Kenosha before they took it away. Mm. And Hector Cantu, who does the comic Baldo, if anybody's heard of Baldo. And I was up against those two, and I thought, wow. I went back and forth between, oh, I can win this, to, oh, my gosh, these are two giants. I'm not going to – there's no way I'm going to take this award. But we did it. We did.
And a little more context, people often say it's like the Oscars. It really is like the Oscars of cartooning. And something that John kind of breezed over, it's an international membership. You know, it's called the National Cartoonist Society, but it is an international organization. So there are members voting from all over the world, you know, not just America, too. And so there are other cartoonists from outside America who win awards at just the same way they do for Oscars. It really is the biggest honor you can receive in the profession.
And it's bestowed by your peers.
This is not the people's choice.
And this is not critics either.
Right.
This is your fellow cartoonists.
Or the Golden Globes.
So, describe the moment when I assume your name was announced.
Well, it's funny. They announce, it's just like the Oscars. They announce the newspaper comic second to last before the big cartoonist of the year. So you have to wait through the entire evening. And as they're getting close to it, you know, for the first time, because I've been down this road before and never felt like this, but somehow or another I had a feeling this would be the year. I could just feel my heart leaping out of my chest. And they announced, you know, Jim Davis, who does Garfield, he was the one that gave out the award this year for cartoonist. So when Jim went up on stage and announced the three nominees, at that point I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know if I can, you know, I could just feel this. And when he announced my name, I just had this sense of relief. I looked at Anne, I went over and gave her a big kiss, and I walked up on stage and
he has no memory after that.
it's like no moment I had ever experienced, because here you are in front of all your peers. I mean, Gary Trudeau's 10 feet away sitting there. You know,
wow.
And everybody's there watching you get this big industry award. And it's a huge, huge deal and an honor, you know. And so I gave a really nice speech.
He gave a wonderful speech.
I just can't remember.
And so I have to wedge in what happened, because I think this happens to a lot of people. So I'm going to make a public service announcement that every mobile phone developer ever anywhere switches the video thing from a red square and a red circle to a green light and a red light, because I tried to videotape his speech. And I thought I hit record when I hit stop recording.
Oh, no.
And so I have not got his speech on video. So let's change that to red and green so we can see it in a dark room.
Oh, shucks.
I'm still mad about that.
But it's nice to be at this point. I mean, this was a 30-year journey. It's been a long journey, Greg. It really, really has. And so much work has gone into it. And to have that is sort of the cap on this, I won't say long career, because my career's not over yet. I'm continuing to do it. To have it happen at this moment.
It's a big boost.
I think having it happen now, as opposed to when I was nominated 4 years ago, or even early on in 2010, it wouldn't have been as special. This made it even more special, because it's just more anguish went into it to get to this point. So
that's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. And does it give you, I assume it gives you kind of a new energy for what comes next? I'm guessing you feel like from this point on you want to continue to be worthy of this award that you were
getting. You do that. You have this sort of, I sat there for the first couple of weeks. I keep the award next to my desk and I'm thinking, okay, I have to live up to this now. You know, no more garbage. I'm not going to put anything out there that doesn't live up to this award.
There's no
garbage.
Know,
it's the imposter syndrome. You're like, wow, how did I get this award? Well, I always do. You know, I never try to put anything out there that's not, doesn't meet my standard. I would never put anything in the paper that I didn't feel lived up to it. And I've always held that high standard, which on one hand makes it a good comic, but on the other hand makes you crazy, because you're always trying to live up to this high ideal, and it's tough.
It seems to still feel incredibly fresh to you, even though, as far as I can tell, not much has occurred in terms of the evolution of Edison Lee. I mean, as far as I know, he's still 10 years old, just like he was back in 2006, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yes. Grandpa's still with us, although by now he should probably be 110. But I mean, you're as many comic strips do, you're holding your characters in a sense in stasis, at least in terms of a lot of the basics. But it sounds like there's nothing inhibiting about that. I mean, that you still are able to find freshness even within a very consistent framework.
Yeah, go ahead.
I want to answer some of that in that I used to watch him struggle to write. I would say the first 4 years were the hardest because you're still learning that muscle. Mm. Now, I always know he's going to come up with the batch. There's never a week where he's going to say, I've got nothing. Mm. It seems he just has settled into it so well.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, when I first started out, I was heavy into the politics, and it was very heavy-handed political commentary. And I just pounded away at that for 2 or 3 years, and that turned off a lot of readers. And I still do that because my syndicate wants me to continue doing exactly what I'm doing. They keep telling you over and over, just keep doing what you're doing. You're doing everything right. So, but I do it in a way now that's a lot subtler.
And less frequent.
Less frequent. And I do it in a way because, and I'll be honest, I made that big shift in 2016. I really did. Because we were all getting tired of the politics around us, and it just felt like a time to pull back. And I did. I mean, I still have
exhausting.
The senator. Senator Ottoman is still one of my main characters, and I use him as a punching bag pretty much for the whole system as it is. And you can't look at him and say, well, he's a Republican or he's a Democrat. He's a politician. And I don't like beating up on politicians because I think, you know, that we have a lot of honorable people that work for our government. But he just offers a chance to poke.
But he's a particular breed of professional politician.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
All
kind
for
of
his own ends. Yeah.
An old school. Yeah. I mean, but in the worst sense.
Because early on, I was targeted as this extreme lefty, you know, because that's one of the reasons King Features wanted to launch me was they needed a left leaning voice, you know, to counter some of the right leaning comics that they had. So that was part of their decision. But I don't want to work that way anymore. I want to be sort of just straight down the middle. I don't want to. It's not that I don't want to offend anybody, but that's just where I am in my life, and I want it to reflect who I am, not who I think people want to see or hear. So,
Well, you're doing something right because you have a very impressive trophy on your shelf, and it is very, very highly deserved. I'm sure everybody who reads and enjoys The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee will completely agree that you are fully deserving of the Silver Reuben for newspaper comic strips. And it's been great to talk with you about the comic strip and where it's been and where it might be headed. We didn't even get to something that Ann mentioned to me at some point, which is that recently journeyed around the rim of the Grand Canyon in
I hiked rim to rim through the middle of the Grand Canyon.
All the way across, 24 miles, is it?
Yeah, but the thing
one
that I'm
day.
Proud of, one day, yeah, which, again, like syndication, I had no idea when I went into it how dangerous and foolish it might have been.
I was going to say that. So it's not temporary insanity, it's just abject ignorance. That
I did that in May, and it was insanely difficult. And just made it up the other, because it's a mile down, all that way across, and a mile up.
And to be fair, he did it with people who had done it before, but they had never done it in higher than 94 degrees.
Yeah.
The day they did it this time, 104, almost all
gosh.
The way across.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I'm grateful that you're alive and well and here to be here, that you lived to get your award. I mean, wow. Well, congrats on that, but more to the point, congratulations on receiving the Silver Reuben for newspaper comic strips. Congratulations to you both.
Thank you, Greg. And, you know, Anne deserves it as much as I do with all her support and all her color. She's just incredible.
So. Fantastic. Well, it's been great to talk with both of you about it, and we wish you well with all of the comic strips that you are yet to give to the world with The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee. John Hambrock and Ann Morse Hambrock, so good to have you here on The Morning Show.
Well, Greg, it's been great. Thanks.
Thank you so
much. Congratulations. You bet. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program. And with her is going to be John Zaborski, who is a research associate with the Wisconsin State Herbarium in Madison, one of the largest herbariums in the world. They have over 1 million specimens of algae, fungi, lichens, and plants that are available to the public and to the world of science for research and study. And we'll be talking about that tomorrow on The Morning Show. And on Monday, among other things, a brief conversation with one of the chief speechwriters for former President Barack Obama. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today's going to be a mostly sunny day with a high of 57 degrees, overnight low of 37 degrees, and tomorrow, under sunny skies, will be warming to a high of 71, and that'll be the story for at least most of the weekend. News headlines are coming up shortly. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical News.